The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
You betcha. We're here to serve you over the next hour, and Employment Law Show is what it's all about, workplace rights, and you need to know this stuff, right? If you haven't caught the show during the week at some time over the last, 11 years, now's a good time to catch up. John Scholes here. Chris Justice is the lawyer joining us, of course. Samfiru Tamarkin, LLP. Reach out any and at all times to Chris and his team if you have questions beyond the hour of this radio program. How do you do that? 1-855-821-5900. That is the way. And help at employmentlawyer.ca. We will try to get to some of your email a little later on in the show. If you've been wondering something about your job, maybe a simple severance question, maybe a little more something complex. News of the day, you sent me, Chris. This is interesting. No need for sick notes in the workplace. What is that all about?
Yeah, so recently we've been hearing about how the Ontario government has proposed the idea of dismissing the need for sick notes, partly aimed at trying to, I think, lessen the burden on family doctors, you know, writing these notes. And I guess the idea, again, being to sort of give them time to focus on, you know, more direct patient care. But having said that, this proposal from the government only right now pertains to the sick days, the few sick days that people get each year that are unpaid under the legislation. So that doesn't necessarily address what happens with respect to policies where you get paid sick leave, but certainly for unpaid sick leave, those few days each year, that's what this proposal is aimed at addressing to sort of, like I say, lessen that burden. And I thought that it'd be a good thing to talk about. Number one, it's like I say, coming up in the news a lot. But number two, it just gets me thinking, well, you know, what ultimately does this do in the grand scheme of things? You know, employers have a lot of times paid sick leave policies. So when it comes to those particular policies, this proposal right now isn't aimed at addressing, you know, do I have to give a sick note for paid sick leave? And so I think, to be honest, in my view, it would make sense across the board just to say, you know, whether it's paid or unpaid, and at least to a certain extent, as far as number of days are concerned, there shouldn't be a sick note. But that's sort of the caveat there, is that, you know, an employer could still have a paid sick leave policy. And under that policy, if you do want your paid sick leave, they may still be requiring you to provide some sort of doctor's note. So whether that issue will get addressed, I think, in the future is up for debate. But that was one thing I wanted to point out, just so that people don't think, well, this means I don't have to give a note at any time now. But the other thing that came up in the news with respect to the story had to do with alternatives to sick notes. So if employees aren't required to, you know, provide a doctor's note, what are they required to do? Is there something in place of that? And a lot of employers are, I think, going to be considering written attestations or declarations from the employee that simply says, I'm sick or I'm ill and, you know, I can't come into work. Rather than requiring a full-on doctor's note, which I think definitely can make sense. You know, as we know, it takes forever in a lot of cases to even get to see a doctor. Not to mention, if we're only talking about a few days off work, I think, you know, having an employee say, I've been sick, and maybe swearing to some attestation could be a compromise. But, you know, certainly if someone's away from work for longer than a few days, course, you're going to need some more justification. But I thought it was interesting, the story coming up and sort of what some alternate proposals being considered were.
I can see the abuse on this one running rampant. It's like, no, mommy, I didn't take the cookie from the cookie jar. Honestly, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. And that's the only backlash. The abuse on this is going to be, I'm rolling my eyes already on this one. Even if you have, so beyond the 10 paid sick days you're allowed through your employer, those are the only ones, I find it very convoluted. Those are the ones you don't need a note for, or beyond the 10 days, then you got to start supplying a note. And as far as seeing your doctor, oh, I can't get in to see him. Dude, around the corner, it's called an after-hours clinic. I use them all the time. Get a note from a doctor. Yeah. I just see employers rolling their eyes and raising their voices saying, no, this is not going to happen. There's going to be abuse all over the place. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think there is the potential for abuse. I think if we're talking, again, just the few sick, so just to be clear, the three sick days, unpaid sick days in Ontario that employees get, that's what the proposal is aimed at eliminating a note for. But if you currently are looking for an absence extending beyond that period of time, or you're under your employer's paid sick leave policy, then this proposal isn't going to eliminate the need for a sick note. And we're kind of back to, okay, I need to provide a sick note. But I do think from a practical sense, if we're talking a couple days, maybe 1, 2, 3 days, that's one thing. But certainly for situations where employees are going to be away from work for longer than that, you know, giving them some ability to just say, yeah, I'm not sick, it absolutely can run the potential for abuse. Yeah. And the thing as well is that if the doctor's note requirement is replaced by having your employee just simply say or sign some document that says I'm not sick, or sorry, that I am sick, that I'm feeling ill, that I can't come in for these few days, then we start to think about, well, what happens if your employer finds out that's not the truth?
Right. What's the backlash if you lie on it? Right. I can fill
exactly,
that out.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So definite potential for abuse. Say you're caught on the golf course, you know, when you're saying you're ill in bed and you can't get out. Well, then there's going to be some serious ramifications. I mean, obviously, you're caught in a lie, serious breach of trust, and that could essentially pretty much almost guaranteed likely lead to a termination or some form of discipline. So potential for abuse is there. I don't think that personally we should be allowing employees the right to just declare whether they're sick when it comes to more extended absences.
Yeah.
But maybe if it's on a one-off here or there, I can see the merit in that. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of how this develops, because as I say, you start requiring other things like attestations or declarations. I'm sure I'm going to be getting a lot of phone calls from people that, you know, lose their job. Maybe the employer says we have solid proof, or maybe the employer just says, I don't believe you. I think there's something off here. It looks suspicious. Uh-huh. And then they use that as a means to maybe get rid of someone or discipline someone, which is a tricky thing. Cause as we know, you start taking chances when it comes to potential illnesses or disabilities people have. And On the one hand, if you're the employer, you could walk out of it looking good and catching someone in a lie. But on the other hand, you've now violated some human rights, maybe discrimination on the basis of a disability. So, yeah, it could complicate things. I'm hopeful that there's a better solution around the corner, at least as far as, like, let's address not just the unpaid sick leave portion, which the legislation provides, but, you know, paid sick days. Because, frankly, most employers have at least some sort of paid sick leave policy.
Yep.
And most employees are obviously going to prefer, I want to get paid while I'm off. So this unpaid sick leave proposal doesn't really address that. And it kind of puts us back in a situation where, okay, well, I need a note from you then. And I agree with you, John, that there are a lot of situations where you can get a note relatively quickly. But then I've also seen situations where someone's sick for a day and the employer is saying, well, get me a note by tomorrow. And if you can't do it, you know, maybe they get disciplined or something. And again, you just open up that can of worms. So it'll be interesting. I appreciate the intention behind the government proposal. I just think that you've got to apply it a bit more better across the board, at least to some extent, not to go wild with it and allow employees this unfettered right to just, you know, self-declare things. But something a little bit more being done.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think they're taking a baseball bat to a hornet's nest with this one. I'd back off this big time if I was the government. But to your point, the abuse on the employee side, and then on the employer side, if they pull rank and all of a sudden they're into a human rights problem for No. I think the government has much better things to worry about right now, like trying to get people houses than worried about 3 days sick days. But that's my opinion, man. Whatever. Lots of time, guys, to get on air and talk to us. 416-870-6400 is how you do that. You can email Chris, help@employmentlawyer.ca. You're having trouble at work, maybe a severance problem. You want to know about that or anything else, just bring it on calls. We've got an entire hour here. Love the topic for today, man. 5 common employment law terms. These are good because we toss them out there every day and every time we do a show. We have been for years. And sometimes we just kind of gloss over them because you, of course, as a lawyer, would understand them. And I've been doing this long enough with you that I understand the terms. So we kind of forget that there's, you know, new listeners every week and every day that say, hey, I'll back up here. I don't quite know what that term means. So we'll start to drill down on a few of these. The one we always talk about, too, and it gets very confused with both employees and employers, is dependent versus independent contractor. Break that down for me, pal.
Yeah. And just before I do that, you know, like you say, these terms are very fundamental. A lot of times we take, you and I may take things for granted, but every single day I still get calls from people, confusing terms, you know, not understanding things. And it's important because with respect to certain terms, your understanding of those terms can mean the difference between, you know, just walking away thinking nothing of the situation and potentially having the right to tens of thousands, if not more, dollars. Independent or dependent contractor, these terms, this is one of those examples where if you get it right, you know, you could be looking at a lot of money, but if you mistake a term for meaning something else, you could very well be screwing yourself over. So let's start with this first one, dependent, independent contractor. Just the term contractor, first of all, is someone who's not typically an employee. They're in business for themselves. They operate their own business. They've got various customers. They manage them. Obviously, if they're in the business for themselves, they've got expenses for this business that they've got to take care of. And they're kind of marketing their services on a contractor basis. You know, John Incorporated, Chris Incorporated, you know, here's my business. I'm putting myself out there, getting clients, getting customers, deciding, you know, who I work for, who I don't work for, how much I charge or not charge, having that sort of control over the running of your business. That is often what a contractor does. Whereas an employee, you know, someone who's got a job, goes to work every day, Monday to Friday, gets told what to do by their boss, finishes their job each day, comes home, comes back the next day, does the same thing. These are the people that are oftentimes being misclassified as contractors because the company's telling them they're as much. And so the question, though, is, are you in business for yourself?
Right.
If you are, more likely to be a contractor, less likely to have rights. But if not, then you're an employee, rights kick in, and you're looking at huge sums of money as far as severance, minimum wage, vacation, etc. So it's a really key distinguishing feature there between dependent, independent contractor, but also contractor versus employee.
Common employment law terms. There's the first one. Lots more of these to drill down on. Some of your emails too. Then we'll get to major myths of severance. How about that? We continue with more of the Employment Law Show. Hang in there. Coming right back.
You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Chorus Entertainment.
It is 10:22 on a Saturday morning. Welcome back to the show. John Scholes, Chris Justice from Sanfiru Tamarkin LLP. Reach out to Chris anytime you would like. Have a discussion. You got some problems in the workplace. If it could be an employer for that matter, doesn't matter. 1-855-821-5900 to do that. Help at employmentlawyer.ca. Chris, we're just getting into our first topic, and that is five common employment law terms. You wanted to keep going a little bit, difference and breaking down dependent versus independent contractor. Continue on, pal. Where'd you leave off?
Yeah, so the only or the main thing I wanted to add on just had to do with another distinguishing feature between a contract, or at least an independent versus a dependent contractor. So normally what the law considers an independent contractor, I sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, is a situation where, you know, John or Chris Incorporated, you've got multiple different clients or customers. Maybe you're doing business for, I don't know, a handful or more of different employers where maybe only each employer contributes to 10 or 20% of your overall earnings. And then you've got another situation where you're a supposed contractor, but, you know, maybe, I don't know, 65 to 75% of your earnings or more are coming from one source. And, you know, maybe there's a couple other companies you do a little bit here and there for, but the bulk, the vast majority of your earnings come from one particular company. And so a lot of times that's referred to as a dependent contractor versus an independent, because they're dependent on that employer or that business as a source of their income. And or they may be working exclusively for one or maybe just a couple different employers. And then if you're in that situation, you're a contractor and a lot of your time and efforts are dedicated to one particular employer, then you will be seen more likely as a dependent contractor versus an independent one. And contrary to a lot of people's perceptions, dependent contractors are actually entitled to severance as well. So it's almost like you got to be a full-on independent contractor, you know, capable of doing everything yourself, having control over everything yourself, and having sort of your earnings spread across the board in a number of different ways before the law is going to say, okay, you are a true independent contractor, and, you know, you're not necessarily now going to be entitled to things like minimum wage or overtime, vacation, severance, that kind of thing. So just so people know, even if you are a contractor but a dependent one, you still have rights that would apply just like they would if you're a full-on employee, so to speak. So important because, again, a lot of people just walk away not thinking of it. And these are the cases where a lot of times you have the most to gain. You know, it's either a case like this or a case where maybe you've been alleged to have been let go for cause and you get nothing. But those are often the two scenarios where, you know, it can swing one way or another in a huge fashion.
So, I mean, the threshold to being a dependent contractor, I mean, we always point to like the plumber, the electrician, they're true independent contractors. Yeah. They work for different people every day, if not every week. They're all over the map, and they just go out and they solicit their own clients. The dependent contractor, yeah. I guess, what's the threshold for that? Is it, you know, if not for, you know, company X, I would be in serious financial trouble if they were to leave. Is that the basic thing? Because I rely on most of my income for them.
Yeah, so the threshold, there's not a, I would say, a precise percentage where you say, okay, as long as I make X percent money with this employer, I'm in the clear, I'm going to be deemed a dependent contractor and employee, and I'll be getting my severance. And that percentage, though, the threshold, you know, how much do I have to be making from one source, has gone up a little bit in the years. I would say you got to be looking at around 65 to 75% of your earnings coming from one source.
Yep.
But it's also, there's a number of factors too. So maybe there's a scenario where you're on the lower end of that threshold, but where the company that you work for has a significant amount of control over you. And then maybe there's a scenario where maybe you're a bit higher in that threshold, but then you yourself have more independence in the way you carry out your business. So not to say one factor will determine everything. You kind of put it all in the blender and kind of see what comes out at the end of the day. But yeah, if we're talking specifically on that factor, usually 2/3 at least to maybe 3/4 of your earnings, that's when I think employers are going to be facing a lot of risks if they're going to push back and say, well, no, this guy was just a gun for hire, so to speak.
Right. Again, lots of time still to call in. 416-870-6400 is how you make that happen. Another common law term, number two, is wrongful dismissal. I guess we could break down wrongful and constructive dismissal since they're, you know, often interchanged by people, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess a constructive dismissal is, I would say, a form of a wrongful dismissal. Constructive dismissal being when your employer makes significant changes to the terms of your job that, you know, changes of which you don't agree to. But that absolutely is a form of a wrongful dismissal. Wrongful dismissal, I would say, is a bit more broad. It can cover a number of things. Usually, though, what wrongful dismissal means is that you've been let go, but you haven't been given a fair severance package. A lot of times people think wrongful dismissal means that, you know, the company didn't have a good reason for letting me go. That's why it's wrong. Or maybe the company, or maybe I found out later on that the company's apparent reason for letting me go wasn't quite what it seemed, or they weren't being completely honest, and therefore that's what's wrong. But that's not really the case. Employers can let you go for any reason, even if it's a bad one. Even if there's some deception there, employers can still let you go. But being stripped, I guess, of your employment rights as far as severance, that's usually what lawyers and what I often mean by wrongful dismissal. It's just not getting that fair package. But you know, still technically, if you're let go due to your age or disability, of course, that is going to be a version of a wrongful dismissal, the basis for it. But people just need to understand that you may not like the reason you were let go. You may think there's, I don't know, favoritism being applied. But unless it's some sort of discrimination going on, you know, I was let go because of my skin color, sexual orientation, whatever. Yeah. Then, you know, employers are generally going to have that ability to let you go. But then the next question is, did you get a fair package?
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of cases I see, people don't get fair packages. And if you're not getting a fair package, my view is you have been wrongfully dismissed. You need to contact a lawyer and you need to, you know, do what you can to make sure you get that full severance.
Number three in the list of common terms, working notice. A lot of people know what this is, but some don't, right?
Yeah, working notice, it's good to bring up because a lot of people get confused. You know, they're sort of let go, or they're told they're being let go, and they're given notice ahead of time of as much. You know, maybe you're working for a company, maybe it's January 1st, and you're told by the company starting July 1st, you're no longer going to have a job with us, and so therefore we're giving you, you know, 6 months or so of working notice. Now, a lot of people think, well, should an employer get credit for giving me working notice? Does giving me working notice mean that I'm still owed my full severance on top of this working notice, or does the working notice sort of chip in or contribute to the the obligations an employer has? And that's actually correct. An employer can potentially satisfy any obligations it owes to you on your way out by only giving you working notice. So say you're owed 12 months of severance, but your employer gives you 12 months of working notice, that could potentially fulfill their obligations, and you know, you would still be required to come into work every day and work out that time. But there are also scenarios where an employer gives you, you know, weeks or months or even years of working notice, but still the law will say they owe you a little bit of money after that in the form of a cash payment. So it's not to say employers can always satisfy 100% of their obligation to you by just, you know, giving you the heads up. But a lot of times they can. It's just, you know, maybe I don't see it so much in my practice, because when you tell somebody they're not going to be working 6 months from now, you're not maybe getting the best out of them for that 6 months. They're not that motivated. And that's why I tend to find in most cases, you're just let go on the day of, you're not given any notice, but then you're being offered a package in lieu of being given notice. But people need to know this working notice thing can be absolutely legitimate and can sort of help towards their employer's obligations owed.
As far as the obligations towards the employer now, if they're giving working notice, it has to be written and it has to have a definitive date. They can't keep moving the goal line on you, right?
Yeah, and I've seen that happen too. Either an employer will come to someone and say, look, I think I'm going to be closing the business by the end of the year. You know, maybe they don't have 100% assurances, but they just say something like, I don't think you're going to have a job by the end of the year. I wouldn't say that's effective working notice. But on the other hand, if you get some letter that says, you know, here's to inform you that 30 days from now, you will no longer be working here, your employment will be over, then okay, the employer can take credit for that. But also to your point, John, if they say 30 days from now, you're going to be done, oh, actually, never mind, you know, we're extending it on a third. Oh, you know what, we're going to extend it. Oh, we were a bit mistaken. We can keep you on a bit longer. And then they try and go back and get credit for the first time they give you notice. That's in a lot of cases where they can get us in some trouble, and, you know, too bad, so sad, but you're not going to get really the effect of those earlier days. You're likely only going to be getting credit for that most recent one. And then just as well, further to your point, John, a lot of times people are being given notice without anything in writing, and it can be very difficult for the employer to actually prove they were given notice. Then it comes down to a he said, she said. So absolutely recommended if you're on the employer side, you want to be, you know, setting the record straight in writing so that there's no dispute there.
We're talking about five common employment law terms we use all the time on the show and always have. Next one down the line is common law. That's what we base a lot of what we talk about on, right, Chris? What does it mean exactly?
Yeah, so the common law is basically judge-made law. It's law that's been created over the past century or two, precedent, basically. You know, a lot of times people who've been let go have gone to court, have gone to trial, have had their cases heard by a judge, and a judge has ultimately said, all right, this is how much severance I think you're owed. And so over the course of that century or two, you know, we've developed a little bit of a line of consistency as far as, okay, it seems like, you know, employees of this age with this length of service tend to get this sort of range if we look at the judgments from the courts. And that's what essentially creates common law. And common law is somebody's, you know, full potential severance rights, which is different than what their bare minimum rights are. So when I often talk with people and tell them what their severance entitlements are, I'll say to them, on the one hand, we've got the employment standards legislation that says bare minimum, this is what you're entitled to, maybe a week for every year of service, maybe a little bit more. But then we've also got your potential, which is not to say you're guaranteed this, but this is further to the common law. So someone, say, who's been at a company for 20 years, at a very small business, say a mom and pop shop, the Employment Standards Act will say they're owed 8 weeks of notice pay. But the common law would say they're owed potentially upwards of 2 years. So I tell people there's a huge difference, of course, between what, you know, the law guarantees you at minimum, and then on the other hand, what the common law says you can be owed at max. And it's very important, of course, that if someone's let go, they have the ability to go after their common law rights. A lot of times people will sign contracts that limit those common law rights, and that's where you get into a bit of a tricky situation, because I'm potentially having to tell long service employees that while you may have had a chance at 2 years had you not signed this agreement, Yeah. You know, it says something about you're not getting common law, and now we're having to consider some, you know, measly little package maybe of 8 weeks for someone that long service.
Lots more to go. Then we'll get into major myths of severance. That's on the way. And we'll continue here with Chris Justice. More of the Employment Law Show is just ahead. Hang on.
You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Chorus Entertainment.
We're back at it. John Scholes and Chris Justice, our lawyer, joining us this morning from Sam Firu DeMarkin. You want to reach out to Chris anytime, discuss your matters. Got a problem with severance or a boss or an employee? That's okay. 1-855-821-5900. Won't cost you a penny to pick up a phone and talk to Chris or his team, and help@employmentlawyer.ca, the email address. And for any other matters, you can also learn a lot about what we talk about on this show. In fact, these five things we're going through, they will be covered for the most part on pocketemploymentlawyer.ca, so you can do your own reading there and have access to what we call the severance pay calculator. And that does exactly what it was designed to do, calculate correctly how much your severance should be. We just talked about common law, and that would fall under that banner as far as how much severance you're actually owed. So put some basic information there anonymously into the severance calculator. It takes about 30 seconds to go through that sucker, and then you'll get a number at the bottom that will shock you, but it's realistic. So have a look at that again, pocketemploymentlawyer.ca. Okay, Chris, last two of the five common law employment terms. Number four, temporary layoff. People love this one. Break it down.
Yeah, so we were talking before the break about constructive dismissals, you know, when there's been a significant change to the terms of your employment. And in a lot of cases, when an employer says that they're placing you on a temporary layoff, of course, what they're doing is they're saying, we're cutting your pay from 100% to zero, and we don't know if we're going to call you back. Maybe we'll try to call you back, you know, a lot of times is what they say. But we don't know. And that is a significant change to someone's employment, unless, of course, they've signed some sort of agreement that allows their employer to put them on a layoff. That's a possibility. Or maybe there's a scenario where they've been laid off, you know, once or twice or several times beforehand, which could, you know, also create a bit of a precedent in allowing that employer to put them on a temporary layoff. But if those two things aren't present, and this is a first time sort of occasion, you have the option, if you're an employee, to say, hold up a minute, I don't agree to being put on a temporary layoff, even if it is for, say, economic reasons or it's in good faith. The employer doesn't actually have the inherent right to do this, even if it is, again, temporary, even if the intention is to call you back. So if you're an employee in this scenario, like I say, you may want to just draw a line in the sand and say, this isn't something I'm acceptable with. And that could easily constitute a termination if the employer says, well, too bad, so sad, we're putting you on a layoff. But if you don't say anything, if you're silent, if you say, yes, okay, that's fine, I'm agreeable, and then maybe you contact a lawyer afterwards to get some advice, that's when, you know, it can be a bit more tricky. But otherwise, the law would generally consider something like this to be the same thing as a termination that's permanent, not just temporary. And then, you know, you're back to looking at potentially those full common law severance rights for forever, how long you've been there, and those factors.
And let's get to this one as well. Many people don't know what this means. Mitigation. That's a legal term, but it's one we often use. Mitigation. Break that down.
Yeah. So we've talked about this on past shows. A lot of people come to me and say, hey, Chris, I've been let go. I'm offered this severance package. Is it enough? And then I might say something to them like, well, you've been offered, I don't know, 6 months of severance, but I think you could get as much as 12 to 14 under common law. However, if you manage to find a job or earn, you know, a new source of income, maybe after you've been let go that you didn't have before, that can actually affect your common law severance rights. So you could have a situation where, you know, maybe you've got two identical people, both been at a company for 20 years, both been let go. One of them, it takes, you know, 4 months to find work, and the other one, it takes a year. Well, the person that it took a year to find a job could, you know, very likely be getting more in severance. So people a lot of times will say, look, Chris, I'm owed this severance. I've put in my years. They shouldn't even care about what job I get afterwards or whatever. But that's what mitigation speaks to, is this obligation on those leaving their employment or being let go to go out and make some reasonable efforts to look for alternate work. And so a lot of times when I'm negotiating packages on behalf of people, we're under a bit of a time crunch, because if they do end up getting a job and we haven't yet settled the case and the employer finds out, then, you know, that can definitely throw a wrench into the equation. But if not, if you're looking for work and you're just unsuccessful, then at least you've fulfilled your duty of mitigation, and your employer is going to likely be more on the hook to have to pay you severance.
Okay, topic two, let's roll into this one. Good stuff this morning, by the way, buddy. Major myths of severance, and the first one's a beauty. Employers calculate severance fairly. Of course they do. Always.
Yeah, always. I can only imagine for the people I speak to, like, how many are just not bothering speaking to a lawyer? How many are thinking their employers do calculate their severance fairly? You know, you get a letter, hey, we're letting you go. The law says we owe you 2 months. Tell you what, we'll give you 3 months. We'll be generous. We'll give you an extra month. All we need you to do is sign this full and final release, and you'll get your extra pay. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, but law says I'm owed 2 months. They're giving me three. That sounds great. But little do they know, the law says maybe at minimum you're owed 2 months. But then we go back to your common law rights and find out that, you know, your maximum entitlements are 2 years, not just 2 months. And then you think, well, geez, I just signed off on a package giving me 3 or 4 months. I had no idea. And now you can't really go back after it. So, yeah, myth, definitely employers calculating severance fairly. I think I mentioned earlier in the show, the concept of wrongful dismissal is a lot of times more so, I haven't been given a fair package. I would say probably over 90% for sure of the packages I see on a daily basis are not fair, are definitely on the low end. And all the more reason why it's just not true that employers, for the most part, are calculating these packages fairly.
Well, yeah, to your point, they're either not doing it fairly out of, you know, ignorance. They don't know any better. They just use some, you know, a friend to tell them what they should do, or downloaded something off the internet. But sometimes, yeah, they're trying to save a few bucks. If they let 10 people go and 9 people don't argue about the severance, well, then they've saved a bunch of coin. But to your point, it's not proper. And again, beyond calling you, Chris, it throws us back to the Pocket Employment Lawyer app and severance calculator, which you can find that. Number two, another major myth about severance, right? Short service employees get little severance, if any. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so a lot of people, again, have this mistaken belief, I've only been at a company for maybe a year, maybe less than a year, maybe a year and a half, and, you know, my company's offered me a month or something of severance. That seems fair to me. I probably get less because I was there for such a short period of time. And the fact of the matter is that short-term service employees get disproportionately larger packages. So a lot of times you might see somebody getting a month per year of service or whatnot. But when it comes to short-term service employees with, say, a year or two, you'll then find that they get maybe 2 or 3 months per year of service, and hence why it's a bit disproportionate than usually. So people need to know that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, let's say I've got a job in a director level, very senior, high up in the company, and I lose that job within 6 months. Well, should I get less money because I've only been there for 6 months, when severance is sort of based around how long it should take me to find work, right? Because if I'm at a job for a day or a month, and let's say I've got a particularly senior role and I lose that job, I'm going to probably have to go back to square one, go in a bunch of rounds of interviews, you know, talk to a bunch of different employers. Like, the time it takes for me to start applying for jobs, to getting interviews, to getting job offers, to signing on the dotted line, I mean, depending on who you are, that could take several months, regardless of how long you're at a company. And so there's usually that, I would say, bare minimum time it's going to take for someone to land back on their feet after losing their job. And that's why I think in a lot of these cases, even if you're there for even a few months, you could be looking at a few months of severance yourself. Yeah. So yeah, like you say as well, John, you'll look at the severance pay calculator. It'll show. You pump in the stats. You know, I've been at a company for X years, 2, 3 years. It's going to come back invariably and say your common law potential is 3, 4, 5, 6 plus months.
You got it. We'll take a short break, get to more of the major myths of severance when we come back. More Employment Law Show is coming up. Hang in there.
You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Chorus Entertainment.
Welcome back to it. It's the Employment Law Show, the Saturday edition. Chris Justice is your guy. He's our lawyer. You want to reach out to Chris afterwards, you're always encouraged to do so. I use him all the time. It's 1-855-821 $5,900 to reach Chris and his team. Help at employmentlawyer.ca. But in between that, our second topic for the morning, major myths of severance. How about this one? If you're fired for doing something wrong, you don't get severance. That's what people assume, Chris. I got canned, so I guess I'm out of luck.
Yeah, yeah. And especially if you're being told that you got let go, and say in the termination letter, there's allegations of misconduct or insubordination or just some work performance issue or whatever. So there might even be of some validity or merit to some of the basis for why you're being let go. But I would almost say, regardless of who you are, if you've been let go and you're being told by your employer that you're not entitled to any severance because of something you did or didn't do, even if you think it's really egregious or serious, I just still tell people, give us a call. At the very least, let's talk it through, because the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of times that I see where employers are saying, you did something wrong, therefore you're not getting severance, I quickly find out either that they're incorrect, that it's just a lie, or maybe they're taking some things out of context, or maybe they are correct, but there's just no way at all that a judge or a court is ever going to say that it would rise to the level, this supposed misconduct, that someone shouldn't get any severance. When someone doesn't get severance for something they've done, usually that's referred to as a just cause dismissal.
Right.
And just cause is the capital punishment of the employment law world. It's reserved for the most egregious of offenders. You know, we're talking people who literally assault employees, who, you know, harass,
steal stuff,
mean people, constantly steal. Yeah. Lie, constantly make mistakes after several years, maybe, and warnings being given and all this stuff. But what I tend to find is, we gave you one or two warning letters about your poor performance and you didn't improve, so we're letting you go and not paying you. Or, we found out you just kind of kept making some mistakes. We're not saying you did anything malicious, but we just don't think you're the right fit, so we're not giving you severance. Or you're not meeting our sales goals. You haven't reached these targets that we've set for you, but then you find out they're essentially impossible to reach, so therefore we're letting you go with cause. Or, you didn't show up to work a few days this week, so we're letting you go without cause. Again, these could be actually correct things that happened, but still come nowhere near to rising to the level of cause. And it's a serious thing, because if there is cause in those very, very, very few circumstances, then yeah, you aren't going to be owed anything. But if there's not, then just like in the case of someone being called an independent contractor and being told they're not owed anything, you could be foregoing, you know, months, if not years, of severance just because you felt or thought that, you know, you did something that doesn't deserve severance.
Another one here, Chris. We'll break it down. If an employee is on a year-to-year contract, they aren't owed severance or notice of termination. No.
Yeah, so I've seen this not as frequently in recent days, but those situations where, I start working for a company in 2015, but rather than signing a contract that says, welcome aboard, we hope you'll be here forever, whatever, I just get told, here's a one-year contract. It's going to cover from 2015 to 2016. And then, come the next year, okay, here's another year contract, 16 to 17, and year after year after year. And at a certain point in time, the courts are going to look at this and say, well, they've signed 4, 5, 6 different year-long contracts. I mean, at what point do they just get deemed an indefinite hire? You know, you can't just be doing year after year after year contracts and then saying because you're doing that sort of forms some sort of notice, or that you're now off the hook, because if you let them go at any point, they would just be seen as an employee with 1 year of service kind of thing, or a 1 year fixed term employee. Yeah. But it's just not the case. And employers, I think, run the risk when they have these, successive contracts, especially ones that get automatically renewed. You're better off just having a contract of an indefinite duration, because you're not going to get away with it, and you're going to have to end up paying these people severance, not based on just 1 year or 2 years, but the whole tenure they've got with the company itself.
I want to get to this one too, Chris, pardon me. You're not owed severance if you're terminated within the first 3 months of employment. What?
Yeah, so that's sort of more related to the probationary period thing. Yep. Where a lot of people think, look, if I'm let go within the first 90 days or 3 months of employment, there's this probationary thing, they can let me go. But they don't realize that unless there's a contract that is worded in a very specific way that says, if we let you go in this period, we don't have to pay you anything, that even if you're let go after the third day, you could be still owed several months of severance. So you want to be careful. You want to look at, you know, is there a contract I've signed with some probationary period language in there? Does it say in that that they can let me go without any notice or pay as long as they do it within that time frame? And if not, you know, that's what I'm saying. You're still looking at potentially a lot of severance, even if you're there for a very short period of time.
Last minute of the show. Let's slide this one in here quick, pal. The Ministry of Labor can help you get your full severance.
Yeah. So a lot of people think, okay, I've been let go. My rights have been violated. Let's go to the ministry. The ministry will help, you know, enforce my rights, and they can to some degree. And I think actually the ministry can be helpful when it comes to things like maybe unpaid wages or overtime. Yes. But when it comes to severance, they can only help you get your bare minimums, the amounts that the legislation says you're owed. We were talking about before as far as the difference between your full common law rights, which could be as much as 2 years or more, and then just those bare minimum rights under legislation, which, you know, could be 1 week or maybe a few weeks. So the ministry can certainly help you get those bare minimums. But if you're in that situation I said earlier, where maybe you're working for a mom and pop shop, you've been there for decades, the bare minimums are 8 weeks, but your potential max is 2 years, you know, the ministry's not going to really help you get what you're actually deserving of.
And with that, we are done for another Saturday. Appreciate you tuning in, and we'll continue on the conversation outside of the hour of the show. You can do so with Chris. The phone number, 1-855-821-5900. Email help@employmentlawyer.ca, and that website, one more time, pocketemploymentlawyer.ca as well. We'll catch you next time here on the Employment Law Show. Enjoy your weekend.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.